You open the fridge. There's nothing there. So what's it gonna be? Greasy pizza? Sad drive-through burgers? Dish by Blue Apron is for nights like that. These are the pre-made meals of your dreams. At least 20 grams of protein. No artificial flavors or colors. No chopping, no cleanup, no guilt. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
It's just a good conversation with someone you didn't know you were interested in. I'm Matt Leon, and this is One-on-One, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
This opportunity presented itself at a time when I was very hopeful and incredibly thankful to come home and be the coach at the University of Pennsylvania, a place that is so dear to me and that I love, that is so part of my family's fabric. So I feel blessed every day when I show up for work.
And our guest this week is Fran McCaffrey. He is the new head men's basketball coach at the University of Pennsylvania. Of course, he is an alum of Penn, was a standout player for the Quakers. And Fran, thanks so much for coming in.
It's great to be here. It's great to be back home.
So since you took the job, I guess we're talking about a month now. What's life been like? Obviously, put your staff together, you know, getting the roster in order. You know, what are the last few weeks been like?
Well, you said it. Those two things are the most important, getting your staff put together and put your roster together. But I guess the one thing that would be more important than that is developing relationships with the players that are here. And I'm very fortunate that so many of them stayed. We only lost one player. And so we have a number of guys returning. So I've been able to get them out on the floor. Now, the first thing I did was address the team collectively and then individually. And then we had the press conference. And then I start working on my staff and then kind of get a feel for what we have, what we might need in this class. Of course, the recruited class, the guys that are high school seniors that had committed to Penn, connect with them as well and develop relationships with them and see that they still want to come. And fortunately, they do. So, you know, I think we have a lot of pieces. You know, and then obviously the next thing is finding a place to live, moving my family across the country. We've got a lot going on with my family. My youngest is a high school senior. He's going to be going to Butler University in the Big East to play there for Thad Mata. His older brother, Connor, who played for me in Iowa, is an assistant coach there. And then my second son, Patrick, is going through the NBA draft process. He was invited to the pre-draft camp at Portsmouth. He'll have some workouts, but he may end up in a summer league team in the NBA or overseas. And then my daughter's graduating from college. So she probably will be the one who moves with us here for a year. She wants to do a gap year before she attends law school.
Surreal coming back?
It really is. You know, the idea of, you know, my office is basically connected to the Palestra. So going to work every day in the Palestra is something that I never thought would happen. When I started coming to the Palestra in second or third grade with my brother, Jack, and my parents, we came every Saturday. That's what we did. And that's what a lot of people did in this city did for the doubleheaders. So I felt blessed to have been able the opportunity to play here. You know, for Coach Weinhau, we had some really good teams, some fabulous teammates. It's been great to reconnect with them. A number of them came to the press conference and will reconnect with the program and come to games throughout the season. It'd be great to see them on a regular basis. But also, you know, the city and the campus has changed a little bit, you know, since I was here. Not that I haven't come back. I recruited this area when I was at Notre Dame. Come back to see my brother, my parents, you know, when they were still alive. But just seeing friends and reconnecting with them and have the opportunity to see them on a regular basis has been great.
What's been the biggest difference on the campus from your days when you were on campus?
Well, I think if you sort of come out of the Palestra and go left, and we always had the hospital, the Children's Hospital, the Veterans Hospital, but that whole medical complex, you know, where Convention Hall used to be, is one of the most impressive things you can see. You know, and you know, selfishly for us, if we have someone, and we had a young man on campus yesterday who's interested in the medical field, really impressive. But as you walk up Locust Walk, there's a number of new buildings. I think it's a great mix of old buildings and new buildings. But like even like the communications area has expanded. The Wharton area has expanded. Like there's just more buildings, more things that really impress me, impress recruits and their families. And, you know, obviously, you know, we aspire to be the best of the best, and we are.
When you come into a program, there's obviously – from a style play standpoint, there's what you want to do, and then you've got what's in the cupboard as far as personnel. What is the push-pull on how much you want to do what you want to do and how much you have to adjust for what's available?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I will say this. You know, we're going to play the way we play, and we're going to find the guys that are going to be successful playing that way. I will tell you that most players, pretty much every player I've ever spoken to or recruited, wants to play fast. They want freedom. They don't want a play set every time. They don't want walk the ball up. So no matter what, not playing that way anyway. I empower my guys to make plays. I've had success doing it that way, and that's how we're going to play. Now, you play fast, and I use this quote all the time, you can't play nuts. And, you know, sometimes I think that's kind of what you're referencing. Maybe you got to scale it back a little if you have guys that are turning the ball over. No, we're not turning the ball over. We're playing fast. We're attacking the defense before they set. And it's going to be a higher possession game. So that means it's going to put more pressure on your defense and your conditioning. So that will be something that's really important. It always has been, always will be for teams that want to score in the 90s. So that's what we're going to do, and that's how we're going to play.
What has it been like just walking around the Palestra now, you know, as opposed to when you were playing here, when you were first an assistant coach? Does it feel different or does it feel the same?
I think that's the beauty of it. It feels the same. You know, we're getting ready, what, in 27 to celebrate the 100th year. But there are few facilities like it in the country. That's why it's referred to as the Cathedral of College Basketball. The only other one that's like it is where my sons are, and that's Hinkle Fieldhouse in Indianapolis, featured in Hoosiers, the movie. There's just not many places like that. And Williams Arena is a little bit like that in Minnesota. There are a few of them left, but even some of those have all been renovated. But the Palestra and its character are, I think, what makes it so special, how sound reverberates within the building. And that's why it was so much fun playing there. Taking the floor there every game was something I never took for granted. I know our guys will feel the same way.
So now let's dig into your backstory. What is your earliest basketball memory?
Well, it would have been one of two things. I remember the first time my father took me to a high school game, and I ended up going to that high school. And then the first time they took me to the Palestra, and my brother and I would sit wherever our tickets were, but then we had to go up into the sections where they were throwing the streamers and pulling out the rollouts, and you know, whether it be the Penn section or St. Joe's drum or, you know, whatever, you know, we were at that point Big Five fans more so than any particular team. I think a lot of people that grew up in that era were Big Five fans. We rooted for all the teams. And of course, when I came to Penn, then it was all Penn. And think about the teams that were on display when I was younger. I mean, those teams in the early 70s were so impressive. I remember the 28-0 team. We watched them the year before it was when we went to Jadwin Gym, when Jadwin Gym had just opened, and watched them play Niagara, the NCAA tournament. We went up there with no tickets and figured out a way to get in. And Steve Bilski, Dave Wohl, Corky Calhoun, Bobby Morris, and then Ronnie Hagler and Phil Hankinson and Craig Littlepage, and right on into, you know, the Final Four teams. Alan Kotler. I mean, they had such really good players over the years. You know, and I used to watch those teams and admire those teams because they won probably more, because all the teams won in those days, but they probably won more than anybody else. So never dreaming that I would eventually wear that jersey. So it was a very proud moment for me.
Did you have a player when you were growing up playing basketball that you kind of set your game after, or that, you know, was kind of the inspiration for how you played?
Well, there were a number of them, I would say. And when I was little, it was the players in the Big Five at that time. I was a guard. So it would have been Bilski and Wall. It would have been, you know, Danny Kelly, Billy Melchione, like people like that. There was a number of really, really good players, you know, in the Big Five. LaSalle had a bunch. I loved Kenny Durrett, Howard Porter, you know, those. Franny O'Hanlon was somebody I watched. But then, you know, when Doug Collins got drafted, I was like thinking seventh or eighth grade, and he came to Philadelphia, and I really admired him, and then had a chance to watch him, and then they signed Dr. J. You know, that group maybe in some ways saved the NBA in the late 70s, because then it just took off from there, and then it was Magic and Bird, then it was Michael and the Dream Team, and then it went, you know, with Yao Ming, it went global. But it was floundering in those days. But I was always a big fan of the NBA because of how great the players were. You know, the Knicks teams and, you know, and Jerry West. I mean, I was a kid and it seemed like he made every shot. Walt Frazier, he was a little bit more on the other end, D'ing up. But it was a great era of college and pro basketball that led to where we are now, which is really pretty amazing when you think about it.
So when you're playing growing up, when do you start to realize you're pretty good?
It was early. And I think one of the things that helped me there was I was the baby in the family, so I was always dragged with my brother, and I played with his teams, who was 2 years older than me, 2.5 years. So I was always playing against bigger guys, and I grew up in a neighborhood where we played in the schoolyard. They used to call it schoolyard basketball. Literally, it was a yard next to a school with two baskets, and we'd play all the time. That's what we did. And then in elementary school, I'm talking like third, fourth grade, we had a pretty good athletic program. I went to a school called Assumpta Academy, and it was ironically founded by a group of religious women led by Mother Dorothy, who was the sister of Ernie Beck, one of the greatest to ever play at Penn. And so she believed in an athletic program. She built a gymnasium. Nobody knew how she got that thing built in the 60s. So we started playing a pretty extensive schedule, and I was one of the better players. And then a guy by the name of Sam Rhines was the coach of another team that we beat, and he went up to my father and said, "Your kid's pretty good. Take some teams around the city. I'd like to bring your son." So my father trusted him to do that. We would go down into North Philly and play in these tournaments. Then he took me to the Sunny Hill League. He took me to the Philadelphia Youth Athletic Association tryouts. So we'd go to New York and play. And I was blessed to have had Sam Rhines in my life at that time. He got me into five-star basketball camp that was invitation only in those days. That changed my whole recruitment. I had a couple of local schools talking to me. After that, I had offers from ACC, Pac-12, Big East teams. Of course, it wasn't even the Big East then, but the teams that were in the Big East. And you know, I felt really fortunate. You know, I grew up our team in the 70s with Gene Banks and Lewis Lloyd and Jeffrey Clark and Darrell Warwick and Joe Garrett. It was the early stages of AAU, and we literally never lost to anybody. It helps when you have the number one player in America in Gene Banks. He was one. Magic Johnson was two. They might argue that, but that's what it was. And Lewis Lloyd was as good as anybody and just so much fun to play with. But that was a special group. We traveled all over.
When it comes to college, you start at Wake Forest for a year before you come to Penn. What made you decide to go to Wake? Were you looking to go away, or was it just the opportunity there?
I didn't want to play freshman ball. In those days, my class was the last class, because they let freshmen play in 73, but the Ivy League didn't change the rule until 78. So I would have had to go play freshman ball and essentially forego a year of eligibility. I mean, you're playing, but, you know, so I went down to visit Wake. They played Maryland at the Greensboro Coliseum in front of 18,000 people. And, you know, I went to the Penn-Princeton freshman game. It was no comparison. But I loved Coach Weinhauer, and he was the one who, not that I didn't like Coach Daly, he was the head coach, but I just had a connection with Coach Weinhauer. And then, of course, Chuck went to the Sixers to work with Billy Cunningham. Coach Weinhauer took over. I went to Wake, really enjoyed it there. really, really had fun playing in the ACC as a freshman. I mean, I was the starting point guard. We played North Carolina with Phil Ford, who was the starting point guard on the Olympic team in 76. We were the game that led into the Super Bowl. So you watched Wake Forest, North Carolina, then you watched the Super Bowl on a Sunday. And so that was pretty impressive and fun and something I really enjoyed. Now, Penn, of course, that year went to the Sweet 16, had a really good team. They had a really good team coming back. And it was at that point I decided I wanted to transfer back home. And now I felt like Penn was the place for me.
How much did that playing in that at that level at Wake Forest help accelerate your development when you come to Penn?
Well, it helped it quite a bit. The unfortunate thing was I got hurt. Well, my first year, the Final Four team, so I practiced every day with that team. I was not allowed to play because you have to sit out in those days. So it was still an incredible amount of fun. That team was special. I mean, you can only imagine. You go to the Final Four, there are characteristics in that locker room that separate that team from other teams that, you know, I've been a part of as a player, as a coach. They had a confidence level that was so impressive to watch. And I could kind of sit back and watch it. Now, I'm going against Bobby Willis and Booney every day in practice, Kenny Hall. But I watched how they prepared. I watched how they competed. I watched how they handled pressure in close games. And I remember we were on the bus going to play Iona and then Syracuse and St. John's, the first three games we had to win. And I'm like, this team's ready. Like, we're going to beat North Carolina in Raleigh, which nobody saw coming. But that team just knew they were going to win. And that was what was so much fun about that. And playing on Super Bowl Sunday and playing at Cameron Indoor Stadium, in packed house, Cole Fieldhouse in those days. It was Carmichael Coliseum at Carolina. Every game was sold out. Every game was on national TV. So there's an element of confidence that comes from that. But then my second year, I tore my Achilles tendon. And so that set me back. And after that, I just wanted to be part of winning teams. I wanted to help Coach Weinhauer and help my teammates. Probably wasn't going to be a star. That's okay. Can I contribute to winning? Can I, you know, and we won. So my two last years, we tied for the regular season championship, lost to Princeton in a playoff, went to the NIT. And the next year, we won the championship and played St. John's in the first round of the NCAA tournament in the Nassau Coliseum. That was an amazing experience because we started the season 3-0, won the Stanford Invitational, came back, played Villanova, then went to Japan, played Louisville and Oregon State. We proceeded to lose 9 games in a row. We hadn't lost 9 games in a row, maybe ever. So we're 3-9 my senior year, and then we went 14 straight and go to the NCAA tournament. So that was an incredibly fulfilling accomplishment considering how the season unfolded. And for me, coming back from a serious injury, and my game was improving because my first year back, I was pretty good, but I wasn't great. And I, like I said, just how can I help? And then the next year, I wanted to be a starter, which I was, and I wanted to engineer a victory and get the team to the tournament. Now, we had better players, Paul Little, Michael Brown, George Noon, David Lardner, Avery Rawlings. You know, we had some really, really good players, but I was the guy that made sure Paul Little got his touches. Michael Brown got the ball, one of the best running big men that I ever played with. I mean, just sprint the floor every time, and I'd load him up. And it was a very, I think, rewarding year for Coach Weinhauer because, you know, we had been winning a lot. Then all of a sudden, wait a minute, 9 in a row. Like, what do we do? We were losing by 1, by 2 in overtime. Like, we knew we could get it fixed, and we did.
The year you had to sit out for the transfer, and then when you have to sit when you're hurt, did that change how you look at the game?
No question. And it changed how I looked at myself. You know, I think when I came out of high school, I was thinking, I can play in the NBA. And then, okay, I'm not going to play in the NBA. And that's a hard decision for a lot of people. For me, it was pretty obvious. I just want to have a great college experience and then figure out what I'm going to do. I didn't come to Penn, quite frankly, to be a basketball coach. I thought I'd end up on Wall Street or somewhere in business. I probably could have. I think now as I look around and see all the guys that were my buddies, the incredible things that they're doing professionally, you know, and I'm just proud that they're my friends, still my friends, you know, but my love for the game sort of drew me into this profession, and I'm very fortunate. I feel like I never had a job in my life.
What is your onboard to coaching, and when did you make the decision that I'm going to pursue that?
Well, what happens is people prepare with internships and, okay, what am I going to do? You know, am I going to do an internship on Wall Street? I mean, up until I graduated, I was working on my game. I was lifting. I was in the gym getting 1,000 shots up. I was playing pickup. Then all of a sudden you graduate and it's like, okay, I got to get a job. Well, my classmates are way ahead of me, and that's something I've tried to get our guys to understand moving forward. You know, let's plan a little bit earlier. But it really was one of those, okay, like you said, okay, you're going to play in the pros? No. Well, your career's over now, but I still love the game. I still want to be involved in the game. It was really only one way to do it. Now, I had an opportunity to go overseas. The money was not very good in those days, and it was kind of like you're prolonging the inevitable. You're going to play 2-3 years. That I think in retrospect, maybe I should have done that just for the experience, live in another country, make some connections in another country that maybe they're valuable in the business world. But fortunately for me, Coach Littlepage gave me my first job. He allowed me to stay, coach the JV team, which they had in those days. They don't have it anymore. What a great experience that was. And so I coached the JVs. And then Coach Snyder got the Lehigh job, and I went with him the following year and helped him build that program. And then he came back as the head coach, and I was promoted as the head coach at Lehigh at 26, which was a tremendous opportunity, obviously.
And I want to put a pin in that, but when you start coaching, was it immediate, like, yes, this is for me? Were there moments of, I don't know, early on, or were you sold right away?
I was sold. You know, and I think we had a great staff. Coach Page was amazing to work for, and I learned so much from him because his philosophy was different than Coach Weinhauer's. But then Tommy Schneider and Tommy Crowley were the assistants, and I love both of those guys. I'm having lunch with Tommy Crowley tomorrow. And so I sort of sat back and was like a sponge because those guys had so much experience. And then when Coach Schneider went to Lehigh, Coach Weinhauer offered me a GA spot at Arizona State where he went. So I was going to go there, but I wanted to get out on the road. I would have been the guy who's in the office all the time. Not that I didn't want to, not that I didn't want to grind, but I wanted to recruit. So I took the Lehigh job so that I could get on the road and recruit. And then fortunately, I recruited Darren Queenan, who scored 2,700 points and changed the fortunes of Lehigh basketball forever.
What was the biggest lesson you had to learn when you started coaching?
I considered myself a really intelligent player. I know a lot. You figure out what you don't know. There's a lot that you don't know. There's a lot that you have to learn. And I think that's the important thing. You know, I'm a cerebral player. I understand the game. I understand offense. I understand defense. Closing out, ball pressure, whatever it is, fast break basketball. But how everything fits, you know, how we teach it, how we coach it, how we handle wins, how we handle losses, how we schedule, how we recruit. Recruit character. It's great to go off a list and say, this guy's rated here and this guy's rated there. I don't care where you're rated. Who are you? What are you about? What's your character? Are you going to compete? Do you prioritize winning? Are you selfish? Those are things that never go away. And then also, we're part of something bigger. Yeah, the basketball team is on campus and we sort of have tunnel vision, but there are other sports. There are other academic programs. You have the faculty. You have the alumni. Understand that you're part of something bigger and try to make everybody proud.
You mentioned you might have had a chance to go overseas had you as a player. I'm just curious. You're still in the game when you start coaching. But was there any restlessness when you're that young and still in great shape of you'd still like to play, or were you able to close the door on that part of your basketball career and make a relatively seamless move to the next chapter?
Well, that's a really interesting question because it's exactly what happened. I wasn't a good enough player to have an agent. But when you're at Penn, there's some really smart people. And we had a young guy who aspired to be an agent, and he became one. And he became a good one. His name was Steve Sherwin. He said, can I be your agent? I'm like, yeah. So he found out that my father was born in Scotland so that I could get a British passport and I could count as a non-American, which increased my market value 100-fold. So he got me opportunities. So they flew me over to play for a work worked out with Crystal Palace, which was the top team in Great Britain at the time. And they wanted to sign me, but my passport, which is very complicated, didn't come through yet. So now I'm in my second year of coaching. Another team finds out that I'm available, and they started recruiting me. Not only, and then they said, you know, we can make you the player coach. Since you've been coaching for 2 years, we'll pay you accordingly. And so I went over there and I played for them right after the season. And it was fun. Put the uniform back on. We played in a tournament in France. You know, took the ferry over from England, from London. And this is pretty cool. You know, let's see kind of what the money looks like. And I got really serious with, all right, this would be awesome. But what is my future? Like, I'm not going to end up the leading scorer in the EuroLeague, you know, making seven figures, which they make now. It wasn't going to be that. Sometimes I wonder what would have been really cool to do for a year or two. But I was offered a promotion at the time. One of our assistants left. And so Coach Snyder said, look, we want you to be the number one guy. So it turned out to be a great decision. I ended up staying as the number one guy. And then the next year, he went back to Penn, and I got the head coaching job. So it turned out to be a brilliant decision, but it was one that was made with some reservation because, like you said, there's nothing better than playing. I love coaching, wouldn't trade it for anything, but playing the game and you know, the idea of playing the game for money would have been something interesting as well, which is what we're dealing with now.
We need to take a break on One-on-One. We will have more with Fran McCaffrey in a few moments. But right now, I want to remind you that One-on-One with Matt Leon is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to drive smarter with high-tech features and excellent reliability. It's time for intelligent design plus exciting performance. Get a new vehicle you'll love. Check out the Honda Civic, Accord, or HRV. Contact your local Honda dealer today. See dealer for financing details. And now on One-on-One with Matt Leon, let's return to our conversation with Fran McCaffrey, the new head men's basketball coach at the University of Pennsylvania. 26 when you become the head coach, yeah, at Lehigh? And you talked earlier about knowing what you don't know.
Right.
Did you feel ready to be a head coach? Was it overwhelming, or was it just kind of because you were on staff and I don't want to say just moving up, but you know, you were already entrenched with the program. Did it seem kind of relatively seamlessly just more responsibilities? Like what's your mind space when you take over?
It's a big adjustment. You're now making decisions. You're no longer making suggestions. So timeouts are looking at you. Practice plan, it's on you. Break the film down. One of the things that was really helpful was the players in force went to the athletic director and said, this is the guy we want. So I felt supported by that group. Now, I was only a couple years older than some of those guys. So there was, you know, other than coaching the JV team, I really was never a head coach. But right away, I was really excited about it. You know, walk into practice, circle up, got my practice plan, you know, and you got to decide how hard you're going to push them. We didn't use the term load management in those days, but you know, how hard do you push them? You got to keep them fresh. You got to get them ready. You got to get them conditioned, but you got to make sure you have your stuff in. You know, when do you put in your press breakers? When do you put in your out-of-bounds plays? And when do you put in your zone offense? Okay, what's your primary fast break? In those days, we taught secondary break. And then what are you running on offense? How are you building confidence with the players? And then you got to figure out, okay, who starts, who subs? Somebody's not happy with their playing time, you deal with that. And then you're on top of them academically to make sure they're eligible and making satisfactory progress. So in short order, it's exhilarating in many ways. You know, okay, my name's on the letterhead. The decisions are made right here. And you got to live with the ones that I'm going to sit here and tell you that every decision I ever made was 100% effective. Sometimes you make mistakes. Sometimes your game plan doesn't work. Okay, it doesn't work. Can you make adjustments throughout the course of the game so you can still get home with a victory at the end? Or are we just, okay, the game plan didn't work, we lost, let's go on to the next one? No. You know, do you have players that can make adjustments? So that's really important. And I really try to assess the basketball intellect and, most importantly, like I said, the character of the guys that we're recruiting so that they can do that.
Do you remember the first time you talk about adjustments and stuff like that as a head coach
that you did something that was almost directly responsible for a victory. It was something you pulled out of a game plan or put into a game plan on the fly or a personnel decision you made. And what was that like to know that you were able to do that? And how much did that fuel you that this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life?
Well, it's ironic. The game that sticks out of my mind wasn't early, to answer your question. It was 2009 NCAA tournament. We're playing Ohio State. Thad Mott's a coach. He's got a great team. We're playing him in Dayton. So obviously the place was heavily weighted towards Ohio State. I thought we had a great game plan. The bids come out on Sunday. We're playing them on Friday. Had plenty of time. Nothing worked. And we were getting our ears pinned back. And timeout, settle them down. Timeout, we're changing everything. Now, luckily, I had a veteran team. Ronald Moore, who's on my staff, was my point guard. So those guys, they were smart. They were tough. So I think we were down 13 or 15. And that thing was on its way to 25 or 30. And we crept back in the game. We did it by pressing and flying around because he was in a matchup. We were attacking the matchup. We thought we had a good plan to attack the matchup. No shots were going in. Some of them weren't very good shots. And when Evan Turner's bringing the ball down and, you know, attacking us. So little by little, we crawl back into the game. And then Ronald hits a three to put it into overtime. Then he hits a three in the second overtime to win the game. But to watch those guys make those adjustments from speed of the game and everything we planned to work on defensively, and then make sure we foul the right guy at the right time. So we were down four. They had the ball under the basket. You know, so they scored. There was 52 seconds to go. Inbound the ball. We immediately foul. Bad foul shooter. He misses. We run the ball down the floor, hit a three. So with 52 seconds, they have the ball up four. With 44 seconds, we're down one, and we're pressing them. And just to watch those guys execute perfectly what we wanted to do under pressure in a game of that magnitude was something that I'll never forget.
When you go from Lehigh, then you go to Notre Dame to be an assistant for a very successful long stretch. Was it difficult to go from being a head coach to being an assistant to being the guy, like you said, that makes the decisions and not the suggestions, to not having that decision-making power? Is that a tough transition?
It was not, because I realized I had a lot more to learn. So I wanted to go work for somebody like Digger Phelps, who had done it at the highest level so successfully. You know, no disrespect to what was the East Coast Conference in those days. I'm preparing scouting reports for Lafayette, Bucknell. Now I'm preparing scouting reports for Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Bobby Knight. And we're playing Indiana on the road. We're playing at Duke. We played Kentucky in the old Bank Four Classic at the Hoosier Dome in front of 38,000 people. That was like the second game I'm at Notre Dame. And we played Kentucky that day, and then 3 days later we played Indiana. So, okay, I'm at the right place. I'm learning. Digger was brilliant with what he taught me. Matty Kokula and Jeff Nix were there to assistants. They were spectacular. But then also, recruiting's different. You know, I'm flying to California. I'm flying to Florida, working in the Midwest. Then, of course, we end up joining the Big East. So now I'm recruiting Philadelphia and Jersey more than I'm recruiting Indiana, because those kids want to play in the Big East. Kids in Indiana, Ohio, et cetera, they want to play in the Big Ten. So it was, you know, it was not the least of which is, you know, I met my wife there. So that was the main reason why it was a great decision. But what I learned, and then, of course, having the opportunity to then work for John McLeod, who coached the Suns, coached the Mavs, coached the Knicks, completely different philosophy than Digger Phelps. So how fortunate was that for me? So I was with Digger for 3 years, with Coach McLeod for 8 years, and learned a lot about recruiting, made contacts throughout the entire country. I mean, I still have people call me, hey, you know, guys that were friends of mine that were AAU coaches, you know, in the 90s are still involved. Call me up. Hey, I got a player. This guy you got to look at. And that's what this business is. It's all about relationships.
As an aside, you mentioned doing the scouting reports. I'm curious. It seems to me, as someone who's talked to coaches from the outside, being an assistant and doing a scouting report of a team or a game would be incredibly nerve-wracking, because I would constantly be worried that I'm missing something and constantly going down rabbit holes of, let me just watch one more set of film. Let me just look things over one more time. Was it like that, and how long did it take you to get comfortable with, okay, this is what we need, and this is how we're going to win?
Before I went to Notre Dame, I didn't think of it that way. I accomplished what I thought was a thorough job, and I presented it to the team. When I got to Notre Dame, I figured out, working for Digger, he was going to come at you with questions. What did Providence do against them? Knowing that Providence was a pressing team, and you better have answers. Oh, I didn't watch the Providence tape. That was going to be a problem for you. You have better watch the Providence tape. You better watch that extra tape, like you just said. You know, and it was harder to get tapes in those days. Like, we were one of the first schools that had a satellite dish. We paid a bunch of money to put a satellite outside of the Joyce Center, and we taped everything. But then we had alums in different parts of the country that would tape games onto their VHS tape and then FedEx them to us. We had a network of people. Because he was going to ask you, hey, UCLA beat them by 4. What did they do? How did they beat them? Or they got beat by something. You better know, if somebody beat a team you were playing, you better know how it happened. What did they do? Did they go big? Did they go small? Did they press? Did they zone them? So you're almost paranoid, because he's going to ask a question and you wanted to have the answer. And you weren't allowed to look it up. You better have it on the top of your head. So whenever I did a scouting report for him, I'd walk on the floor. Everything was in my head. I didn't have a sheet of paper in front of me or anything like that. Okay, they're going to run thumb down. They're going to line up this way. They might move some personnel. This is how we're going to guard it. You know, we're going to switch here. We're not going to switch here. We're going to front the post. We're going to weak side help, whatever. And next play, subs. Next play, next play, next play. And then these are the out-of-bounds plays. These are the side OBs. This is our press attack. We had to put sequenced highlight film together for the team, which was all done manually in those days. Now you can do it on computer, but, you know, so you're doing man offense, zone offense, press offense, out-of-bounds plays, any defense that they might play, and you better have clips of everything. So they could see it all sequenced, and they could have it in their head, like, it can't be, we come out of a timeout and they're on a 1-3-1. We didn't practice against a 1-3-1. You didn't know they were going to play a 1-3-1. You better know they're going to play a 1-3-1, and we better have something ready to go. And boy, did that make me a better coach, because that's how I think, and that's how I challenge my assistants.
And that would be the nightmare I would constantly have, is that the team did something that – and I would wake up in a cold sweat going, oh, my God, I didn't prepare for the 2-3 zone. What are we doing?
Like, well, I can tell you this. The best story I can ever give you about that, and it speaks to the intellect of some of the Notre Dame kids. So we flew out to play UCLA. Now, when Digger went to Notre Dame, he went there because he wanted to beat Wooden, which he did. He did it a lot. So we're going to play UCLA. It's my first UCLA scout, and he is wired. Questions, questions, questions. So I had watched 30 tapes. I had all my sequence numbers ready to go. I was going to make it. I didn't have time, because I had a game before, to make all these tapes before I left, but I was going to make them when I got there. Well, in those days, the equipment had different numbering system than the equipment we had. So now I have how many hours of tapes have I watched? How many notes do I have? And I can't make the tape. And I have to present at 8 o'clock in the morning, and he is going to lose his mind. He's not going to hear any excuses about the equipment at the Century Plaza Hotel is different than it was. So me and the graduate assistant and one of the managers, was 2 in the morning, so we're up. And he says, take the numbers you have, multiply it by 1.07, and I bet the new number will be where the highlight is. I'm like, dude, how do you know that? He was an engineering student. He goes, that's the multiplier effect. He said, I promise you, it'll be right there. And sure enough, now it still took us 2 hours to put the tapes together, but he saved me a lot of embarrassment, because I would have had nothing.
Right.
Or I would have tried to watch what I could watch in the next 4 hours, not sleep, and be ready for the meeting. Because he was a guy that he didn't want any excuses. And if he would always say, like, if you said something, he would say, well, you assumed. Don't assume. His 3 rules were, don't assume, follow up, have a backup. Follow those 3 rules and you'll be successful in life. He had that on his desk. So I never forgot that.
So long stretch at Notre Dame, head coach UNC Greensboro, Siena, before you get to Iowa. As a coach, when do you start to feel like you really hit your stride? not that you had mastered it, but you had your arms around what went into it, what it took to be successful, what it took to connect, what it took to recruit successfully. Like, is there a point where you really feel like you became the best coach you can be?
Yeah, I felt like when I got to Greensboro, I had my Lehigh experience. We talked about that. Go to Notre Dame, worked for two of the best to ever do it. It was time. I was like 40 years old. I had recruited nationally. I had coached against the best of the best. Time to take over and run a program. And that was a lot of fun. My years at UNCG, I had a great athletic director in Nelson Bob, who empowered me to be successful. I had a great staff. Billy Taylor came with me from Notre Dame, and Kenny Dempsey, Errol Koziak, Brett Reed, now the head coach at Lehigh. So it was that run. Was I better prepared at Siena? Yeah. Was I better prepared at Iowa because I was at Siena and Greensboro? Yeah. But I was ready to go at Greensboro.
Does success hit differently at the different places?
If you have success and you watch your players celebrate and enjoy that success, it's equally satisfying no matter where you are. And we did some amazing things at all three places. I mean, the first tournament we got to won the conference championship. We scored with 2.9 seconds to go to win the game. Go to the NCAA tournament at Greensboro, at Siena. We had a great run. In the championship game of the conference tournament, four straight years, won it three times. Beat Vanderbilt, beat Ohio State in the NCAA tournament. And Iowa had a drought before I got there. And then we got to the NCAA tournament for the first time in a long time. And then we sort of did it regularly for a while. And it's a different feel at the Power 5 level. You know, they sort of expect to go. And it's not easy, especially when you're in an 18-team conference. You're not getting 18 teams in. And the teams that don't get in are really good. But the jubilation, the satisfaction, the sense of accomplishment is exactly the same.
So you take over at Iowa, I think 2010?
2010, yep.
Were you prepared for the level of scrutiny at that Big Ten level of having everything talked about, having like talk shows, I'm sure, discussing your decisions and stuff like that? Like, was it as much as I'm making it out to be? And if it was, like, did that take some getting used to?
It would have been, but I came from Siena. We had our own TV stations. We had our own newspapers. I had my own radio show. I had my own TV show. It was the biggest thing in the Capital District. We had press around all the time, guys digging up dirt, talking about you on the internet. Every decision we made, every game, scrutinized. I remember Paul Hewitt said it when he went from Siena to Georgia Tech, how important it was for him to have been at Siena. It was the same for me. Was it different? Yeah, because the entire state lives and dies with Hawkeye basketball and football. You know, you grow up here, there are Penn basketball fans, but people love the Eagles, the Phillies, the Flyers, the Sixers, other Big Five teams. There, it's Iowa and Iowa State.
How difficult is it to deal with criticism at that level from people that it is very obvious they don't know what they're talking about, but they are very loud about it? Because I'm sure there's a lot of that. Like, why didn't you do that? And they have no idea your personnel, stuff like that. I'm sure a lot of it you have to let just roll off you. But how annoying is that?
Well, for me, I just looked at it as part of the job. What was difficult for me was when they attacked the players. And that's going to get more intense now that the players are making money. But I could tell you stories that you just can't believe how guys were attacked with direct messages. We had a horrible experience with one of our players after an NCAA tournament game. And it wasn't even a Hawk fan. It was a gambler threatening to kill him and his whole family. And you think, what are we doing? Like, we never should have let the gamblers in to the game. I guess it was deemed to be impossible to keep them out because they were betting anyway. So try to legalize it in some capacity. But we let the gamblers in. What happens with these kids and prop bets and things like that? It's awful. So the internet changed everything there. Everybody has a voice. Twitter, like you said. And it might not be, and this is the hardest thing to get the guys to understand. Somebody's attacking you and they pretend to be a Hawk fan or whatever team you're coaching. It might be a fan of one of your competitors pretending to be an Iowa fan coming after you. You don't even know who that person is, but it happens so frequently now with people getting attacked. The sad thing is when fan bases develop an opinion about something and then the media reacts to that instead of doing what you said, do your homework, know what's what, know personnel, know the situation. Because sometimes administrations fall into the same situation. And, you know, I've been pretty lucky with that over the years. But it's just, I think to go back to the point you made a minute ago, if you don't let it roll off your back, you won't be able to do your job. You'll go crazy. But it's oftentimes hard for the players and their families when they're being attacked. Because I think sometimes they're attacked way more than I am. To me, I get paid. Say whatever you want about me. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's playing the wrong guys. He doesn't know offense. He doesn't know defense. I don't care. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to stay loyal to my guys. But when you have 18, 19-year-old kids getting skewered and then other people run with it, that's not right. But guess what? We're going to be dealing with it because it happens.
You had a ton of success at Iowa from that run. What do you take away as your favorite memories?
The favorite memories to me, the first is I got to coach my boys. We celebrated a Big Ten championship at the 10-second line with them. And they were a big part of it. And that was special. But what I remember are all of the relationship I have with the players. Seeing Luka Garza as a 15-year-old and watch him get the Naismith Trophy, the National Player of the Year. I saw Keegan Murray play in fourth grade. Then I saw him be the fourth pick in the draft. We gave Jordan Bohannon a scholarship. I said, what are you giving him a scholarship for? He's not a Big Ten player. He scored 2,200 points for me and is the all-time leader in assists at Iowa. I mean, there's stories like that, you know. Even a guy like Ryan Kreener, his goal, he just wanted to play at Iowa. He's an Iowa kid. But I could keep going. Tyler Cook. I mean, Devin Marble, you know, was my first guy drafted. Aaron White. Everybody's recruiting a guy on his AAU team. We were recruiting Aaron White. Come play for us. He scored 2,000 points. But going to work every day with an incredible group of young people. You know, watching Peyton Sanford last year play with two torn labrums in each shoulder and make 8 threes in his last college game. Everybody would have shut it down, got surgery, and got ready for the NBA combine. He played right through it. You know, it's things like that that happen over the years that make this profession what it is. And to go back to your original point, a lot of times people don't understand. You know, Josh Dix didn't make a shot in one game, and he's taking heat. Well, he had a broken bone in his wrist, and he taped it up, and he tried to play. He didn't play well, but he played well the rest of the year. One of the best players in the league, one of the best players in the country, you know, and just showed up and kept his mouth shut. Coach, I'm ready to go. Didn't make him play. He was playing. So I could keep going with stories like that, but that's what it's all about right there.
You mentioned coaching your sons. Was there a challenge there of juggling coach and dad?
I didn't feel that way. They were subjected to more of the scrutiny, more of the BS that you were referring to before on the internet. They were criticized way more than they should have been. Or deserved. Connor is second in the history of Division I basketball in assist turnover ratio. It's pretty impressive. We won 111 games with him. It's a lot of wins. Patrick, same thing, 1,000 point scorer. I won over 100 games with him. So we shouldn't have to apologize to anybody. But, you know, for me, showing up every day and seeing my sons. And I remember it's exactly what John Beilein said to me because he did that with his son, Patrick. And I said to him, what do you think? He's like, I saw my son every day. That's all I need to tell you. I see my two boys every day. We would travel together. We would enjoy the journey together. Ups and downs. Tough loss. There were some tough losses, but a lot of highlights. And doing it together was the best.
Biggest change in you as a head coach now as to when you were 26 at Lehigh?
In those days, I was more fiery. Why? It's kind of what you were supposed to be. I was never, you know, a crazy man at my players, but I was more so in those days. Like, I don't really get on the guys a whole lot, you know, and it's never personal. You know, if I get on the team, it's going to be the team. We're not doing this. We're not tough enough right now. We're not connected. We're not utilizing good shot selection. It's not you didn't do, you're soft, you this, you that. It's never that, you know, but when I was coming up, you got yelled at. That's what coaches did. So in the beginning, like, am I supposed to be yelling more? Like, I never was really that guy. I feel like, just tell me what you need me to do, coach. I'll do it. And that's kind of how I treat my guys.
Final question. coming full circle where you're now coaching in the town you grew up in, the arena you used to go to, the place you played in college. Like, could you have drawn this up? Like, if I would have brought this up to you 20 years ago, would you have been like, ah, well, we'll see? Like, it's almost storybook to be able to come to this at this point in your career.
It's funny you say that. My mother always had a saying, and she borrowed it from a friend of hers. Convenience and opportunity rarely meet. Well, it did. You know, this opportunity presented itself at a time when I was very hopeful and incredibly thankful to come home and be the coach at the University of Pennsylvania, a place that is so dear to me and that I love, that is so part of my family's fabric. So I feel blessed every day when I show up for work.
Fran McCaffrey, thanks so much for coming in.
Appreciate it, Matt.
And that will do it for this week's episode of One-on-One with Matt Leon, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. Want to thank new head men's basketball coach at the University of Pennsylvania, Fran McCaffrey, for coming in studio, being our guest this week. Now, if you like this show, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, do us a big favor. Leave us a rating and a review. It would really help us out. Now, you can follow the show on X at One-on-One Pod. You can follow me there as well at Matt Leon 1060. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check us out again next week when we bring you another conversation with someone you should know more about.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.